Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudavanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
They'll be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance.
Excellent. It's wonderful to have Professor Bukola Salami on the episode of this podcast today. Professor Bukola Salami holds a Canada Research Chair Tier 1 in Black and Racialized People's Health and is a full professor in the Department of Community Health Sciences, Femin School of Medicine at the University of Calgary. And she's also the Scientific Director of Equity, Diversity and Inclusion for the Alberta Children's Hospital Research Institute. Dr. Bukola Salami founded and leads the African Child and Youth Migration Network, a network of 42 scholars from four continents. In 2020, Dr. Salami founded the Black Youth Mentorship and Leadership Program. And this program is the first university-based, fully interdisciplinary mentorship program for Black youth in Canada. And this program seeks to socially and also economically empower Black high school students to meaningfully contribute to Canadian society. Dr. Bukola Salami has received several awards for research excellence and community engagement, too numerous to mention at this time. But we will definitely get to many of this as we continue in this podcast. Selina?
Thank you so much, Motilola. Indeed, I was looking at Dr. Salami's profile on the University of Calgary website. Oh my goodness, she has achieved a lot. And we cannot articulate everything in this introduction, but we're hoping that throughout this episode, we'll be able to cover some of this amazing work that she has done. Dr. Bukola Salami, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Much appreciated.
Thank you. So we would want to start by understanding where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Akure, which is in the south western part of Nigeria. But we also tend to also not just talk about where we are born, but also talk about where our parents are from and where my ancestors are from within Nigeria. So my ancestors are from Efoala Ekiti, which is also in the southwestern part of Nigeria. That's where my dad is from, and where my mom is from, Ezejero Ekiti, which is also in the southwestern part of Nigeria. So I grew up in Akure, and I went to Command Secondary School, which is in northern Nigeria, for 4 years. I started high school in Nigeria at around the age of 10 years old and moved, some hours drive, I think between 4 and 8 hours drive to northern Nigeria. And I did 4 years there. And then I decided, no, I'm tired of, going into a military school. That school is a military school. I went to a school in southern Nigeria, in Akure again, which is St. Matthias. Before then, at the age of 16, my mom came and said, time to come to Canada. And I came to Canada at the age of 16 and spent my time before university at the University of Adam in Toronto from the age of 16.
Amazing, Dr. Salami. It was so great to hear you talk about Ejiro Ekiti and Efoala. My mom is from Aramoko Ekiti, so I know those many Ekitis, and I am from Ondo Town as well. And it's so wonderful to hear you talk about your secondary school experience. How beautiful is that? So you had this wonderful time growing up, I believe, and just wanted to find out, had you always wanted to be a professor?
No. I think I always wanted to be a doctor. When you're growing up, remember in African communities, you really have three professions, okay? You have to be either a doctor, a lawyer, an engineer. Okay. Anything beyond this is not an option. So, to me too, it's like, okay, you choose. I'm one of those. So I always wanted to be a doctor. And, that's the path I followed. Even up to high school was to become a doctor. And when I was 16 years old or 17, I was involved in a summer mentorship program at the University of Toronto, and it was to prepare people to become doctors and to increase the representation of Black people in medicine. And I was fortunate enough to attend that, which expanded my perspective, but also exposed me to one nurse. And that is where the consideration of nursing came. And of course, things just evolved. I do have an uncle, my dad's younger brother, who is a professor and was the vice chancellor or president of Ekiti State University in Nigeria, the university in my state. And but I never really, my memory of him and his days is, those days there was no computers. He had a room that was full of newspapers. Right? So I didn't imagine my life would be full of newspapers, although things have changed now. But that was my experience.
Awesome. Please tell us a little bit about how it was coming to Canada at 16, leaving a life that was familiar behind and coming to this country that has a different weather pattern, different food, different people. How was that like?
Well, thank you for mentioning that. And I remember, when my mom came a couple of times. So the first time, she came, it was, to do all the arrangements, get us our health check, and so on and so forth. And I was excited. And when she came back and wanted to actually take us out of Nigeria, I sort of said no, because it's like I was having this much fun with some of my colleagues and my friends in Nigeria. And I think my mom's, friend sort of looked at me and said, everyone wants this golden ticket. You have it. And I was able to be convinced. But I think, when I got here, it was really realizing that what you see on TV is not really the, my perception of Canada was, as people say, the land of gold, milk and honey. Everything is like, everyone is living in a house, there's no apartment. You have this ideal perception of Canada, and when you come, you realize, oh, no, it's not like that. And yes, there are homeless people, right? There are people that actually do not have homes, and there are also some cultural nuances too that you get a sense of. I remember, you know, one of the cultural nuances when I came the first year, I was on the subway, on the Toronto subway, and we were talking about one of my sister's friend in Nigeria, and I told my sister that she passed out. In Nigeria, I think it's passed out that it's still being used. It's like that means she graduated. My sister almost fainted because, right? Because the first thing my sister thought about passed out, that means she fainted. She probably died. Oh my God, my friend is dead. To me, I just meant there's good thing happening in your friend's life. She graduated. So, you know, there's those cultural nuances that you get to Canada and you get exposed to.
That is so funny. And as soon as you said that, I remembered other cultural nuances as well. Because when you said passed out, I also felt, oh, did she faint or die? And then it suddenly occurred to me, oh, she graduated. It's how we say that's a troubleshooter or something, when we actually mean someone who causes problems and all of this. So, Mrs. Salami, how did all of those experiences then shape your establishment and how you continue to lead the networks that you lead? For instance, you founded and you currently lead the African Child and Youth Migration Network. You also founded in 2020 the Black Youth Mentorship and Leadership Program. How did all these experiences shape your contributions to the lives of Black youth in Canada?
In terms of how the experiences have shaped my contribution, I think I actually appreciate the fact that I was born in Nigeria. One of the things that, you know, my parents, you know, did when we were in Nigeria is every Christmas we go to our hometown. Don't tell my uncle, especially, and my dad. You know, if I say village, if I say town, it's like it must be called a city, okay? Okay, but I would say it's between a village and a town when we go there. Because some of those experiences still ground me, right? I know where I'm from. I know what my ancestors have been able to achieve and been able to overcome in the past. Even, you know, despite some of the struggles here, I know that in our context that there is that several opportunities exist. And I know also that, you know, I have cousins and stuff that have also achieved a lot in their profession. And I think sometimes when I was growing up, I would think, okay, no, this is my cousin, and actually that cousin now is now in Toronto. I would say, okay, well, she did it. Maybe I can do it too. So I think that helped me. And I think there's the other piece too is, Motilola, I know you went to Nigeria, and I don't know if you went to a boarding school in Nigeria. You know,
I
boarding
did.
schools in Nigeria shape you. I went to Command Secondary School, and it was one of the most toughest boarding schools in Nigeria. You know what, some of the things that that does for you is really, really get you to be resilient. If
Yes.
you've been through command, and I didn't survive because I got out after 4 years, I got fed up. But you know, you get really, really strong, and you know, you get knocked down, get yourself back up. And I remember, you know, several schools will have their motto, you know, of life. And you know, growing up, I went first to a Catholic school, and that really taught me issues related to truth and honesty and integrity. You know, in my elementary school day, it was a beautiful elementary school, Bishop Hughes. You know, I hope it's still the same. I was in the first set. And I went through that, which was very, very nice, beautiful elementary school, to going to a school that was very, very discipline focused. So I got us, you know, training in terms of also you need to be disciplined. So you need to, you know, be honest, you need to have high level of integrity. And then I got into you need to be disciplined, you need to be resilient. And I think in a lot of the things that I have seen so far, when you've went gone through a rough path of a 4 year rough path, you also learn in terms of they knock you up, you get up, you know, just like a soldier. You keep fighting and you keep running. You know, that is, you know, one of my things. So, and you know, my parents, I also remember, you know, I got to also to learn very early on that, you know, for me, and I think I have been to some extent conditioned to overperform. And I should accept myself as an overperformer, because what I learned very early on is for me to actually be seen as performing, I have to overperform, right? So I overinvest, I overdo things. I don't want to be at the borderline. Because when I'm at the borderline and when you're foul, So there are people that it's like, okay, this person is not even meeting the requirements. So people are not gonna talk. If you're a really, really privileged person, people may still look at your file and still consider you even if you don't meet the requirements. But as a Black person, you know, okay, right? And then I think the tricky place that Black people find themselves is when they're in that to be discussed, right? And to be discussed, and when things are to be argued, then that gets a little bit more complex. So for me, the way I've been able to navigate this is to ensure I am not in the to be discussed category. I overperform so that you don't even have something to discuss about me. And that is some of the ways that I have navigated.
I totally hear you. And I want to ask, after high school, I read on your bio that you went and did an undergraduate at the University of Windsor. Then you did your graduate studies at the University of Toronto. Between high school and tertiary education, did you do any part-time work? Did you do anything between finishing secondary school and starting post-secondary education?
Yeah, so and thank you. I'm not at a kind of interview like this in the past, and it's good to always have time to reflect. It's actually very therapeutic to sort of see, the maneuvers and how I got here. So my parents tried as much as possible to shield us, but of course, finances, you need to get a part-time job as a high school student, okay? So I did a few part-time jobs. There was a job where we went into different stores and we counted and tried telemarketing, but I wasn't good, my accent, and I'm not good at convincing anyone. And, but the job that I did for a long time before I finished high school, I think I did it for a year in my last year, was working at Tim Hortons, working at Tim Hortons. So, just like any high school student, I tried so much to work at McDonald's. That was like my dream job at that time as a high school student. But I wasn't hired at McDonald's. So I worked at Tim Hortons, and in my during my university, I didn't work during the school year. It wasn't, yeah, I didn't work during the school year. I did get student loan. So I got the maximum of student loan that you can get. So I think at that time it was, maybe 11,000 a year, and 3,000 of that, was, or 4,000 was scholarship, and the rest was a loan. So I did get that, and I worked during the summer. So I would work full time during the summer, and I did a few jobs, and one of those was working in nursing homes. So many of the nursing homes in Toronto, I was working for an agency. I've worked there. I worked different nursing homes. So I had a job in nursing home with an agency. I also worked with people with developmental disabilities, working in group homes. So, there are several of the group homes in Toronto too that I've worked before going around. And there was also a pharmaceutical job that I had. Just because my mom was working there, they provided employment to the staff of their to the employees, the children of the employees. So I worked there. So my strategy was not work during the school year, but overwork during the summer, right? So school year is for me to focus on studying. And then summer, and then I just try and save as much money, which doesn't really end up being a lot, but at least, if it can help me buy some products, buy my books and things, and the student loan can then meet the rest. So yeah, that is, what I did in terms of, going through, school.
Excellent. It's so amazing to hear you speak about your dream job at the time.
Yeah, my dream job. Oh yeah, my dream job. Like I used to look at all the kids that were working at Tim Hortons at McDonald's, but then I felt content and okay once I was able to work at Tim Hortons. Because at least that's another cool job for a high school student.
That's so amazing, and I'm sure that your skills as a barrister at Tim Hortons
Yes,
really
yes, yes. You learn a lot of skills, navigating
you
people.
do
Yeah.
you definitely do. How do you think any of these experiences that you had during this time propelled, but also contributed to your academic trajectory?
So in terms of the experiences that I had during this time, I think my educational experiences were, some of the things that helped in terms of my trajectory. So, when I got to the University of Windsor, I was able to, form a network, have friends, and many of them were Black students. And, we supported each other. We did our study group and things, and that sort of helped us to be able to move forward. And that's what Black students tend to do, especially when you know that you may experience racism. It's band together. It's more difficult to break a broom than to break just one stick. Of the broom is much easier. So that is some of the things that we did. I also engaged in extracurricular, not as much extracurricular, but with a Black student, African student group, and so on and so forth, and church. I also went to church, and church was very, very important for me because it wasn't just the spiritual element too, it was the community and finding community support. Then okay, if things drop, there's someone that you can easily call and say, help me here, do this little thing for me here, and I think also that, distraction from school, that, you have a time that you do something else. African churches, I'm sorry, it's dance time, okay? It's dance time, it's time to be happy. When you're in the house of God, there's fullness of joy. Okay? So that was good for me, and spiritually good for me. So
Oh, that is fantastic. And between finishing your undergraduate degree and starting your graduate studies, did you take a break? And if you didn't take a break, why did you continue through?
after I finished my undergrad studies, the first thing I did, because it took about 4 months or so for me to get my license, because you have to write a nursing registration exam and you can be a nurse. So I worked at a summer camp, loved it. It was a summer camp for children with disabilities. It was beautiful. And I worked in Toronto at the Hospital for Sick Children for a bit, and then decided I'm gonna go to for my master's. At that time, I saw some people at SickKids that were doing their masters. I also knew that, registered nurse was not all I wanted to be. I also, at that time, also considered going into medical school, but the master's route was the route that opened. So about 1.5 years after finishing, I did my master's. The good thing about that time was the SickKids are self-scheduling. So they are self-scheduling, which self-scheduling, it's not an absolute self-scheduling. It's self-scheduling while also recognizing the needs of the unit, that you're working with. But at least, you have some control over your schedule, as opposed to most nurses where, people just give you schedules of, and you don't know when you're gonna work, and it's hard to combine education with it. So because of the self-scheduling, I basically wouldn't take a vacation, but I would schedule vacations for the times when I know a paper is due or an exam is due. I'll schedule, put my vacation time during that. So I was able to continue working about 80% shift throughout my master's. And I think it was during my final clinical for my master's where I needed to be working that I dropped my hours and, worked much less hours at that time. So yes, I applied. I only applied to one school, University of Toronto, and did my master's at U of T. And I will tell you, now, I'm a talkative person and so on and so forth. But let me tell you the truth for anyone listening to this. I was very, very, growing up, I was very, very quiet kid. I was an introvert. I was extremely, extremely quiet. I never said a word during anything. I remember my master's class. I would go, come out, not say a word to anyone. I would go to church. They know me at church. Come out. I won't say a word to anyone. It got better when I went to Windsor, especially at the church community. It got better. But what really was helpful for me was, I think it was around during my master's or so, I got much more involved in, being on committees. I was doing a lot of volunteers on the side with Registered Nurses Association of Ontario on the International Nursing Interest Group, with Sigma Theta Tau Anonymous Society of Nursing, with on the membership. And that sort of, taught me in terms of, when to talk, when not to talk, how to conduct yourself on a committee, and so on and so forth. And I think over time, like now, people are like, oh, Bukola talks a lot. Before, oh my God, try to get any word out of this girl. You're not going to get anything out of her. So that was really, really helpful for me. So after my master's, I did about 8 months stint at Toronto Public Health, and then I started my PhD. And then a job got open to teach cultural competence at SickKids. And that job was actually sort of, it was good for me, because that job I was basically teaching cultural competence, the same curriculum, to like 1,000 people, 30 at a time. So I had the opportunity to teach the same thing over and over and over again. And that honestly was my introduction to teaching, and to perfect my skills in teaching, because then I wasn't learning the content, but I was doing the same content, so then I can focus on the teaching style more. And that helped, and teaching assistant and so on and so forth.
Wow, that is so wonderful. And no, you're definitely not the person who, not that girl that we couldn't get any word out of. Otherwise, we wouldn't be having this podcast. But it's so wonderful that you were able to perfect, if I dare say, your teaching skills while doing that job. What are your current research and teaching interests, knowing that you've had lots of years, many years of experience teaching and researching?
So I do research with immigrant populations, Black population and racialized populations. I am currently Tier 1 Canada Research Chair in Black and Racialized People's Health. My focus is focused on addressing health inequities. I'm also Scientific Director, EDI, at Abada Children's Hospital Research Institute. So there is a lot that I get myself that I do in terms of addressing inequities. So I've done work on health of children, mental health of Black children, access to health care for Black children, culturally sensitive approach in terms of COVID-19 pandemic. I have done work on, what is the best strategies to collect race-based data from Black populations, and so on and so forth.
You have been involved in around 90 funded research projects, and 30 of those you were leading them, and you have over 100 published peer-reviewed journal articles and so on and so forth. How do you become so productive as an academic?
Now, there are different ways to do it. So if you watch my top trajectory, right, when I started, I used to be first out on a lot of papers. I used to produce much less papers. My first 2, 3 years, maybe I'll have between 1 and 4 papers a year. Now it's grown to between 20 and 30 papers a year, and it may even grow further than that in future years. So as early career researchers are listening to this, I was talking to an early career researcher lately, and she's like, oh, the faculty that she wants to work in, that usually they expect 10 publications. And I'm like, go for it. Go for it. There are ways that people actually structure this, so it is knowing the style. For me, what I do is I invest my time in writing the grants. So once you write the grants, you have your literature review done. You have your methodology. Now what you need is your results and your discussion section. Okay. Now, as an academic, you should also be training early career researchers. So you get an early career researcher on board, you get a student on board. You mentor them to help you collect the data. You also mentor them to write the paper, and you mentor them to also be a co-author on the paper. You've written the literature review, but it has to be revised. They can help you with some of that. So they write the results section, you write the discussion section, voila, you're done, move on. If it's a bigger study, you may be involving maybe two, three students. And this is mutually beneficial. It's beneficial for the students. They get training, they get paid. They also get a publication. Oh my God, life cannot be beautiful. For me, it's beneficial for me. It's effective. We move through this and we get there. Now, I think as a researcher too, one thing that early career researchers from Black and racialized populations should also think about is the student you bring in can help you, or they can also make it more difficult for you. So if you're really, really good in terms of mentoring and positioning students for success, and mentoring really, really strong students, then that could really help. So for example, some of my publications are because I'm supervising students on it. So if you're a researcher and let's say you have three students, and it's students and you are very good during the interview process and selection process to ensure those students are very, very motivated to actually do work and they're really good and you really spend your time training them. Let's say over the years, let's say they put out three or four publications during your PhD and you encourage them because publication also gets them money to be able to win grants, right? They get publication, they are much more suitable to be able to win grants. It's good for them. You get three or four that you're mentoring, and if each of them is producing one a year, that's four publications that you're not the one actually writing. You're also not the one going to be first author on it, but at least you're going to be somewhere in the author line because you've contributed and you've mentored them throughout the process. So that means automatically you already have four. Then let's say you are co-author on this other three other four grants that someone else is leading, but you're involved in, that then you could also be your four potential ones. And then you have your own research where you're also mentoring some other group of students to be able to actually help. So easily you can see now how it will germinate. But when you're starting out in your first year of a tenure track faculty position, that is much more difficult. So you have to build it up over time. But I think the other thing that is a challenge for early career researchers from Black and racialized backgrounds is that sometimes it's difficult to get people to invite you to be on their research project or to be on their grants. And then it's very, very hard for you to jumpstart because you see people from white populations that automatically they get invite from these big time researchers that already have their program established, and that they're able to publish a lot within a period of time because of that. So that was a challenge for me too. And it's a challenge for many of us. What I also tend to do, and I don't know if I should say this, is I like the power of I am new. I have the power of please be my mentor, because you'll be surprised when you ask people, please be my mentor. Honestly, having 10 mentors is good for me. I can have as much and I can name everyone my mentor. Okay. Basically, what I'm saying is I'm inviting you to help me. And I think we should be open to that, making those invitation of please be my mentor, please help me, and I will recognize you for helping me. So I have sort of used that, and I also encourage people from equity deserving communities and all the early career researchers to have trusted senior colleagues. Trusted senior colleagues that can help you in terms of navigating and navigating at different levels, navigating at the faculty level, navigating at other levels. So I would absolutely encourage people to get trusted senior colleagues. And sometimes those trusted senior colleagues can also, and I like what you guys are doing, oh, honestly. And this is what I did when I got to my first faculty appointment. We started at $2,000, looking for $2,000 grants. We started out looking for $2,000, then it went to $5,000, then it went to $10,000. And now if you access come and apply for a $10,000, $25,000 grant, you say, oh my God, not worth my time. Sometimes you just start with, but you need people that have the same motivation, the same zeal as you, because at the same time, you don't want to, getting pulled down, right? So sometimes you just get those connections. And it's like, for example, if two of you are working together, or you have, for us, it was two or three Black women working together. One person is doing that, one person is doing that. And if each of us can be producing one publication a year and supporting each other on it, then at the end of the year, we have three publications a year that we've all produced together. But then that also relies on us all combining together. So if you have those three publications, and then you also have all this other mentorship that you're doing in terms of training, then that also helps you in terms of positioning yourself, which in the way you need to prioritize also ensuring that there's mutual benefit. Because I think what sort of often happens in academia is people do things like that, but then it's not benefiting those that are actually helping them in the process. So In my team, I have a rule of 25%. You write 25%, you become a quarter. And that's what I encourage. You know, if you've collected the data, you might as well participate in terms of writing, and you might as well become a quarter. So that then in the end, you know, we are all collectively growing, especially within the Black community, where we really, really need growth of early career researchers. We can all lift ourselves up, and no one is drowning at the same time.
Wow, this is beyond amazing. Thank you so much for all these tips. You know, I've been learning a lot, hand lifting, hand pulling everyone along together. I go on X and I see all the people tweeting at you saying they've benefited from your mentorship. I think it's the time I should just say it and be open that this podcast, in fact, has benefited from your mentorship and your kindness in connecting Selena and I. We wouldn't know that we existed in our little corners of the world at McMaster at the University of Calgary. And I think it's wonderful what you've been speaking about and but what you continue to do for Black early career researchers and also Black people. There's a lot of emphasis on Black people and immigrants. I was just wondering, why do you focus on immigrants in particular in trying to lift people's hands and working together? And all of those beautiful things.
Well, first, you know, that group experienced difficulties, but I think some of the things that I also do is when I do research with communities, I try to build capacity of the communities. So the overrepresentation of Black people, immigrants in my research is also because it's that mutual reciprocity. And reciprocity is so important in terms of partnership. And I think there are researchers that work with communities, and they are not building the capacity of communities at the same time. I try not to do that. And because I'm building capacities at the same time, if I'm, for example, working and doing research with Filipino communities, I should, you know, try as much as possible to see how can I build the capacity of early career Filipinos within that. And I think lately a lot of my research has been with Black people, but I also think about, okay, how should I build the capacity of Black people at the same time? So it's part of my research agenda, but I should say I do have some non-Black, non-racialized people on my team, but I would say many of those non-racialized, non-Black, for you to work on my team, you need to be anti-racist. And if you're Caucasian, if you're white, you need to be also comfortable in your own identity and be anti-racist and be self-reflexive. So I have had people come into my team. Actually, my longest serving research assistant is white, and she's been working with me for 6 or 7 years now. I call her my institutional memory. So when, you know, people in the team come to my team and I'm trying to remember, what did we do 5 or 7 years ago about this? I'm like, go to Mia. Mia would know. So yes, so and that is one of the things, right, in being an anti-racist. So, and I also I think my background as and my experiences has also led me to create mentorship program for Black youths, and that is deliberate based on my personalities, the challenges that I faced, and the challenges that I am trying to overcome.
That is amazing work. Thank you so much for generously sharing all those ideas and tips. And so, to talk about your teaching, what is your teaching philosophy? And is there one course out of the many courses that probably you would have developed throughout your career that you say is something that you would want to talk about?
So in terms of my teaching, right now my teaching load is not a lot, but you know, when I was in the early stages, I was, you know, 40% teaching, 40% service, 20% research. I've taught courses on international health, on global health, on immigrant health. That was the one that I like. And there was an interprofessional course that I also like teaching, and I've also taught courses on community health. Some of my philosophies related to teaching is really, really, you know, teaching in terms of social change. And, you know, when I come into my class, I talk about respect and the need for respect. And I think respect is so much important in everything that we do. You know, even in research, respect, trust, and reciprocity is important. And maintaining that environment of respect and also ensuring that people have atmosphere to be able to ask questions and to be able to discuss, because I really rely very much on Paulo Freire's pedagogy of the oppressed, and sort of looking at how can we actually towards emancipatory learning. And in, for example, in my culture, and Motilola and I, we are from the same tribe. When you ask an elder about a question, they do not oftentimes will respond to you directly. They may ask you a question back. And it's through that questioning that you get to actually get a deeper sense of what the question is, and also unravel what you already know that you may not know that you know, and situating that within the current context. So sometimes I do use questioning in that sense to be able to situate things in terms of the knowledge that is being gained, to also ensure that people are also reflexive in terms of the approach. So, and when I'm telling, one way for early career researchers, if you want to lighten up your workload, I have said a few tips for Black early career researchers and racialized, is be careful who you bring in into your research team. A mentor. So if you do, put the emphasis on early stages, so on your grant writing, on early mentoring, so that then you reap the reward, and also looking at people's motivations. The other thing that can really reduce, not all teaching are created equally. And we know that, you can get one teaching and be like, oh my God. And oftentimes if you teach the same course over and over, it's often good because you can reuse, but you know that sometimes you don't have that luxury. You're putting new courses every time, which means you have to develop teaching materials, and it's like teaching two courses all the time. But when you teach in your field, it is so much easier. So of course, my field is immigrant health. When I teach immigrant health, I love it. That's the best course that I like to teach in terms of, my teaching. So I have also had a few people on my team come into my research program that are not my students and are now actually assistant professors, associate professors. I think by July I'll have three that I associate professors, and I think 10 altogether, or between 10 and 12, that have at some point come through my research program. So you do, and that is one of the joys, right? When you see, some of the people that have gone through and were mentored before and got practical experiences and are now actually excelling in their careers, and now they're your co-investigator on their project, right? It's very, very fulfilling. And this is one of the fulfilling parts, because at some point we're all gonna retire. And really, what have you left behind? The people you've mentored, the impact that you've made for societies and communities, the dents that you've made, and this is the beautiful aspect.
I really love the way you explained your pedagogical and your teaching philosophy, using questioning to situate knowledge and ensure that people are reflexive. Awesome. Moving away from work, how do you relax?
Don't ask me that, because it's not good. It's not good. I work, I overwork, and maybe I have to slow down. Maybe after this, I always say after each meeting that maybe I'm gonna slow down. But you really ask me, how am I getting this done? Is yeah, maybe I don't sleep. I went to bed maybe 3 a.m. this morning. This is one of the things. But I think when you're so motivated, you see the potential for change. And you see the potential that the work that, and you also see that, there's not too many people that have this position or capacity to be able to affect the change that we require to be able to drive equity forward. You're really self-motivated to be able to move some of this and to be able to also move some of the dial. Some of the things that I do to be able to drive equity forward. So yes, it's a self-motivation, and maybe one of these days I will be able to so in terms of work-life balance, honestly, let me confess my sins. I'm not a good one to see about work-life balance, but hopefully I will learn.
I have to also learn how to keep that balance in check.
Yes, I think we do. We do have to learn. It would be good if academia was 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, and all be done. Although I do know one of my colleagues I don't know how she does it, but she's very productive. She's a racialized, oh, no, she was my first research coordinator. She's now, she's going to become an associate professor. And I heard she only works 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, and so on and so forth. So I think I should be, Mrs., how are you getting this done? Teach me, because, she's also doing well, really well. So.
Oh, sounds good. So, in terms of food, what is your favorite food?
I like plantain. Fried plantain is probably my favorite. I would eat fried plantain any time.
Wonderful. Fried plantain is such a joy giver. I mean, if you when I've had a very hot day and I just fry plantain, I am excited. All right, that's wonderful to hear. Of all the countries that you have visited, which one is the most memorable for you?
Well, I think I would say the country I was born. There are lots of memories. I mean, is there any other country? Of course, you can think about some of the nice places, Florida, Mexico, Dubai, and so on and so forth. But I think the most memorable places is the country I was born. And I remember my hometown, Efon, Alaye, Ekiti. It's a hilly town, so many of the houses are on hill. And I know your mom's hometown is, we are actually sister towns. I remember we used to go to the river. There's I think they call it Omi Ororo, was the name. So the water, the Ororo River. Bathe in the river. Do all sorts of things in the river, in the waterfall, in the river, and that nature of things that you wouldn't get anywhere. The breeze, when, and I don't know if it's because it's in the mountain, but the weather and the temperature and the breeze and just going through and feeling so much pride and honor, an indigenous of the town. I don't think that is my home. That is, I know that is where I belong. That is, where I'm accepted. So I would say, that is really my best place.
Thank you so much. That is very interesting. And do you have a favorite quotation?
Two that I think I use a lot, and sometimes you will see this if you're on my WhatsApp, and I will put it on my WhatsApp every time. I think the two ones that come up a lot is carry out a random act of kindness. But I sort of switch it. It is Princess Diane's quote. To me, it's not just straight in the knowledge of someone is going to do it to you someday, but it is also in the knowledge that you're making the world a better place. And I so much believe in random acts of kindness. I get emails every day, and that's what actually makes me busy. If you look at my calendar, is not the productivity. It is not the publication. It's the amount of meetings that I have with strangers, with students, and in different ways that I, 99.9% of it, will not benefit anything from it. So oftentimes people email me and I always respond. I've also been blessed by total strangers. And I so much believe in random acts of kindness. So, I try to. When people email me, I almost always respond, unless if I think it's one of those spam, come and give me $1 million, someone just died and has $1 million. Those ones I wouldn't respond to. But when people, students and so email me, I respond and I meet with them because I think at the end, I'm carrying out a random act of kindness. And actually, one of those random acts of kindness, someone just emailing me and me deciding to meet, has actually sort of benefited the university lately, which is the person, said, let's meet. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to meet with you. I have 30 minutes. Tell me what you need. And the person is like, I want to bring Kimberly Crenshaw to Albada. And Kimberly Crenshaw is the person that coined the word intersectionality. And I'm like, okay, give me your thoughts. And it's like, okay, I have done this before and I brought this person. Okay, I'm like, okay, if you bring that person of that caliber, maybe it is possible that you'll be able to bring Kimberly. And yes, Kimberly Crenshaw is coming to the city of Calgary and to the University of Calgary based on just my purpose of random acts of kindness. He wanted my help and I tried to help him. And then it ended up actually also helping me and the university in the process. So I believe in random act of kindness. The other thing that I quote that I really live by is the first test of integrity is its blunt refusal to be compromised by Chinua Achebe. And, I don't know if people have read Things Fall Apart. If you've not read it, please, please, please go and read it. It's all about colonialism of Africa and the richness that we have in Africa before we were colonized. That really speaks to me because as a Black person, as an African, oh, and please, you are also Nigerian. You're 419 until you're proven innocent. Okay, you are 419. You are what you call this? You are about to scam someone. You're about to lie. You're untruth until you're proven innocent. And some of the ways, there are some principles that have gotten me this far. I've talked about respect, hard work, reciprocity, random acts of kindness, but also very, very important as Black and racialized people, prioritizing your integrity. Especially when you start moving up, people will try to poke. If you're still in your bachelor's now and you think, okay, maybe in the future, I want to become, I don't know, a member of parliament. People are going to poke into your past. So better start strengthening it up now. It is not 2 months or a year or 2 years before you apply that you start actually strengthening things. Your history now matters. And that integrity has been important to me all along. Right? And sometimes you do have tendencies that sort of once make you divert. And from that way, oh, this is a way. And it happens to a lot of people in our community. I'm struggling so much. I'm experiencing all this with all the work that I am doing. I cannot get over and be. And you think that, there's a fast way. There's an easy way to be able to actually achieve what you want to achieve. And your integrity is so going to be important in the future. So, as I said, I believe in random acts of kindness. I believe to maintain your integrity. Try as much as possible to be at peace with a lot of people. Your relationships are important. And also, workout resilience is so important. And actually, I would say I take caution in terms of working hard. I work hard now. But honestly, during my undergrad, I shouldn't say this, but I would say this. What made me do better during my undergrad is sleep. Sleep, and I see it in a lot of students. And sorry, now I know I'm going off track. I see it in a lot of students. They have an exam. They would study, study, study until 3 a.m. in the morning, and then sleep for about 4 hours and come for an exam, right? And when you ask them, yes, they are working hard. They are really working hard, but maybe they are working too hard, right? And if you have just closed your book at 11 p.m. and gone to sleep and have yourself a good 8 hours sleep, you would have a clearer brain to be able to actually do that exam and to remember everything and to think critically. Because remember, in Canada, it's about critical thinking, right? It's not about memory like we have. So, and the critical thinking requires you to eat well, to have good sleep, and have a clear brain. So if there's any undergraduate student or student writing exams, think about your next exam and please just try it. Try this. Sleep for 8 hours at night. I don't do it anymore now, but I used to do this when I was a undergrad. Okay, sleep for 8 hours at night. And then during your day, try to get like about 45 minutes of nap. Okay, before then, you also continue your work. It doesn't matter. So some students will want to read their work about three times to prepare for an exam. You don't have to do that. Okay, go and sleep. Read it once. And after sleep, and then read it once. It will stick very well. Okay, and come for your exam. Or read it twice. You don't need that third time. Okay, that would help you to be able to actually do better. Because I see a lot of our youths that struggle and with this. And it's also very, very important the community that you form around yourself, the positive environment that you form around yourself, and the support systems that you form around yourself. The challenge is sometimes you feel very isolated, right? So you don't really know some of the things that may be going on within the broader classroom environment and the community environment. So I think it is very, very important to also socialize with other students. I mean, we do talk about learning from Black. I feel that the best thing is to have your feet in both, in the broader community, in the Black community. The Black community will help you feel grounded in your identity and make you feel proud of your identity. But then you still also, especially if you want to shatter the glass ceiling, still need to know about the broader community and what's happening there.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I was really taking notes, but also smiling as you were mentioning many of the things that you said. And of course, the random acts of kindness, we are all testifiers to how very effective that has been in getting many of us ahead in what we're doing. I was going to ask you about your latest media article, the one in The Conversation. What was that about? Yes.
I think maybe before you read what it was about, read the comments. I don't know if you read the comment section of that article. Oh yes, you should read the comment section. So I wrote in The Conversation lately. So I should say this, one of my goals. So I had that goal of working in McDonald's at some point in my career. Honestly, it was a goal, that not to work in McDonald's for the rest of my life, but to work in McDonald's as a high school student was my goal that I actually didn't get to achieve. But then I also have always had this thought about, oh, I want to write an article for The Conversation. But it's like I have so much research going on that I don't have time. So I finally did have time. And it was looking at Black people's health and health outcomes of Black population. And talking about some of the broader social determinants of health of Black people and the higher mortality rate that Black people experience in terms of some of the outcomes. So that is what that article was about. And I am hoping soon to write another article that will be focused on mentorship. So that was the first mentorship, and I may be proposing another one after that to focus on this whole thing that we talk about intersectionality. So, what is intersectionality? What are some of the things that people have gotten wrong about intersectionality? And, how do we actually, think intersectionally in terms of many things in Canada? And I may be concluding. So I am also trying to align this with some of the priority focus, and I may be concluding with something about anti-racism. We talk about anti-racism every time, but how can you actually be anti-racist? What are the key ingredients of anti-racist? So, yeah.
Oh, thank you so much. I look forward to reading the article and the comments as well. But a question, how do you handle some of the comments that come, especially from trolls or people who just say negative things in response to your writing? How do you handle that?
Oh, honestly, I remember there was one I wrote article in the Edmonton Journal, or was it Calgary Herald? I don't know how the person knew where my Facebook page was. I don't have a Facebook now, but I got this thing about, 419, Nigerian 419, go back to your country and blah, blah, blah by an email. The person sent it to my Facebook and I tried to locate the person and I don't know, maybe they shut it down their Facebook or something. Or they might have just set up that Facebook to send that, message or so. And I remember that one was it was really, really, I think after that I actually contacted the communications people at my faculty and in terms of how can I, and I remember I had to change the name on my Facebook. So I think I had Bukola, but I didn't put my last name. It was, I put an initial or something, and I know, that is some of the things some people face. And I remember I had a Black colleague, senior colleague, and I had to sort of debrief with them about what's happening. The one that I currently have that happened just some days ago was like, okay, this is just very, I just see it as okay, the paper is called The Conversation. So maybe we are having the conversation. And I actually like that they put it out there because, this is some of the things in terms of the racism that we still continue to experience. And I think some of the things they wrote, it's like, the racism is quite clear in it. So I don't I try to navigate it as much as possible. Honestly, I think I treat it now more as when you receive reviewer comments on grants. When you receive reviewer comments on grants, honestly, this is what I usually do. It's very, very funny. I sort of peep at the reviewer comment, and maybe I'll read a couple of lines here and there, and I'll close it, put it aside for when I'm in my happy place. And on the day that I'm in my happy place, I can, okay, I'm gonna read another paragraph. Heal myself from the wound and go read another paragraph. So, at some point in time, I'll get to read everything, but just take it as much as I can handle. And but I think, this is where the community is important. The debriefing is important with our trusted senior colleagues, and it's always good when you have people that can see from your perspective and you that you can actually share some of these thoughts and what's going on with.
This has been such an eye-opener, and I am so blessed in particular that you mentioned some of your experiences as a Nigerian, because you're almost criminalized until proven innocent. And it's very tiring many times just walking around with that baggage. Selena and I spoke about Afrophobia in Southern Africa at some point, and maybe we should write that paper. I think we need to write about it
Definitely.
now. I just wondered, Dr. Salami, if there was anything else you wanted to add, maybe more tips for early career researchers, in particular Black people.
No, I don't. In terms of tips, I think I've talked about publication strategy. I may add that, one of the things, when you're working in a large team or large group of other researchers is sometimes, early on, I develop a publication strategy so that all the researchers that I'm working with know, okay, you may not be on every single paper, but your turn is coming. So, when I have a large team and let's say, we can potentially produce four papers from this, develop a publication strategy so that then, you ensure that there's equity in terms of, at least everyone has a publication and coming out of this. In terms of grant writing, I think learning early on, grant writing is important. And please, 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 if you're a researcher and you get into a faculty position, as soon as you can join the grant review committee of your department, please join. The more grants of other people that you learn, the better you're going to get in terms of writing your own. The more you read, the more you see bad ones and good ones. And CIHR can also gives you opportunity to observe grant review sessions. So I would really, really encourage you to go for it. So that's some of the things related to grant review. And the other committee that I think it's good, if you're a PhD student, I would say if there is a selection committee in your faculty of, selecting new professors, join that committee because then you learn what is considered and what you should prepare when you're looking for a job. The other committee that I've also enjoyed is being on tenure and promotion committee, because if you want to get promoted, that is while the dynamics that happen within your faculty related to tenure and promotion. And you can also situate yourself and prepare yourself to be able to actually meet some of those. So service is often not rewarded as much. So don't pile yourself up on too much service, but then you can strategically position yourself for service. And I am sorry to say this, one of the things that we run into as Black and racialized faculty members is people often put you on EDI service all the time. Okay, so you're on EDI this, EDI that. Now, at this point in my life, I don't really care. I can be on EDI of everything. Okay, it doesn't affect me so much. But I remember when I first got to my fac first faculty appointment, the first thing someone put my name on was EDI. And I'm like, please don't go forward with it. Right? Because what happens is you get in, they're looking for this Black person, and then they're looking for you to come and change and address all the issues that have been happening over the years. And, now turn everything around just like Superwoman, turn it around. But at the same time, you don't have the support that you need to turn that thing around. So it's very, very difficult, right? So I often tell that assistant professors in their first 3 years, try and shield them from that. Now, there are some assistant professors in their first 3 years that should do it, right? So there are some people that, let's say, their work is on EDI in nursing education. So it may make sense for them to be on the EDI committee because it's going to help them with their work. But let's say, my work is looking at microbial resistance in whatever, and it's not related to EDI, and you just want to put me every time on EDI, not rewarded. So I would encourage that, for the first 3 years, if there's any administrator thinking about this, to try and shield Black and racialized early career researchers from EDI related work. Give them tenure. After giving them tenure, then you can now start inviting them and telling them to do EDI stuff. Because what we also see is Black and racialized people get positions, and people are wondering, she's not performing, she's underperforming, she's not producing too much, right? But then people don't think about, she's doing all this other work. What is the, how many Black people come and knock on her door, and it's like, no one is going to recognize her for that problem that she's solving for everyone that is not allowing her to do her job. So whether or not you like it or not, they're already doing EDI work, okay? Try and shield them. It just means not that they're not doing it, but at least you're lessening the load for them so that they're not overdoing it.
We appreciate your answers and thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us on the Black Professors Podcast. It's been such an honor, but a delight as well to chat with you and to learn from you. And I know that posterity and those of us still here will thank you for these wise words of wisdom nuggets that you have dropped with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University,
and Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.